I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our exploration of the Indiana story for the state's bicentennial. We'll talk about Hoosiers, the multi-part documentary based on historian James Madison's book of the same name that is airing now on WFYI. We will look at not just the past, but what the future holds. My guests are James Madison, the state's preeminent historian, Perry Hammack of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission, and Kim Jacobs, the documentary's producer. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or reaching out to us via social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about all things Indiana. The springboard for the conversation is Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's WFYI's bicentennial documentary series based on a book of the same name by James Madison, the state's preeminent historian. The first two episodes have aired and are available to watch online. You can find them at WFYI.org. And the second two episodes are going to air August 4th. They're being simulcast on all IPBS stations, and the entire series likely will re-air this fall. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got questions about Indiana's history or how we're celebrating our birthday, you can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests today are old friends of the program, all. Starting with James Madison, who is the author, historian, and also the host of the documentary series. Perry Hammack, who is executive director of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission. And joining us by phone is the documentary's producer, Kim Jacobs. Welcome to all of you.
Hi, John.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you all here. So, Jim, I'm going to start with you on this, because in some ways, one of the things that always fascinates me about projects like this is, in effect, you're telling the same story here. How does it change when you shift from one medium to another?
That's a great question, John, and one that I've struggled with. I'm kind of an old-fashioned historian in some ways, and doing television is very different from writing a book and even different from teaching a history class at IU in Bloomington. I had great help from Kim Jacobs, the producer of the first three parts, and she kept saying, "Now, Jim, remember, this is television, not history." And that means you have to be even more focused on what the main points are. You have to be focused, I think, on a potential viewer sitting there with a remote clicker in her hand and tempted to turn the channel, and you don't want them to turn the channel. So we worked very hard, and the team here at WFYI worked very hard to meet the needs of television audiences.
Kim, I'm gonna throw this question to you. What were the challenges as a producer? Because even though a documentary is a long form in television, exploration of an issue or a story, it's not the same as a book. You can't go into the kind of detail. What were the challenges in trying to boil down Jim's book?
Well, the challenge was working with Jim, because he is masterful at what he does. He's a masterful researcher. He's a wonderful writer. And we wanted to honor him. His name's on it. His voice is on it. And trying to boil that down, I think what Jim does very well is tell stories. And it's not so much a political history and a recitation of dates and times and locations. It's what happened. It's a social history, how people lived, and what was their, what did they eat? Where did they live? You know, how cold was it? And I have to tell the story on you, Jim, because at one point we're down on the Ohio River, and Jim turned around and looked at me and goes, He goes, those pioneers who put their stuff in those flatboats couldn't swim. They fell off, and it was horrible. They drowned. And it just made me think for that moment, if Hoosiers could just know these things, they'd want to know more. Does that make sense?
Were there difficulties in trying to figure out ways to tell the story visually? Kim, I'm going to throw that one to
Sure, visually, but I think, you know, when we talked about this, we agreed we were going to talk to people who knew their families' stories. So we had pictures of those families. We had pictures of their towns. A lot of our cities around the state have digitized photos of their past. And visually, let's do a big shout out to Kyle Travers and all of her research into finding those pictures through the Historical Society and Dave Tarr, because there are hundreds of pictures, hundreds of historical images that we use to help these people tell their stories when they didn't have family pictures or when the towns didn't have pictures.
May I interject here that one of the things viewers will see are beautiful aerial shots of the Wabash River, the state capitol, and many other sites, mm-hmm. because we had a bicentennial drone. And that drone camera did some fantastic work.
Well, and I should say, part of the reason I'm pursuing this line is I've read Jim's book, which is marvelous. I've seen the first two parts of the documentary, which are also marvelous. And my question really is about points of emphasis here, about how we approach the same material
I'll tell you what's new here. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, it's Jim. We're following Jim's lead on this. And he says, we could recant all that we already know. And it's, you know, white guy history. Mm-hmm. But the story that hasn't been told much, and sometimes if at all, is the history in our state of African Americans and women. And for instance, we know about the Roberts Settlement. A lot of people know about the Beach Settlement and Lyle Station. But if you look at what the Indiana Historical Society has done in terms of taking a survey, where did African Americans live? Did you know we had settlements in almost every county? We didn't know that. Yeah, but that's what you're going to find in here that's different, that's new. It's the voices of people that haven't been heard before.
Perry, how important is this retelling of the state story, particularly at this moment in our history when bicentennials are one of those moments that lend themselves to reflection on where we have been, where we're going, as birthdays do, I guess.
We use that a lot, both in looking backwards and looking forwards. But as has been said already, the bicentennial really has one of its major emphases on getting people to tell stories and stories that don't involve their thumbs, you know, more than 140 characters sitting down. And I know if Kira Amstutz was here from Indiana Humanities, she would say the same thing with the all-in program. And we're working now on bicentennial porch parties and other things where, you know, when I remember my own family's history, my grandfather and great-grandfather, their focus was really on looking forward. And a lot of the family histories get lost. And this is a great time for people to remember that family history, but then also to apply it towards children and next generation, you know, our overarching project of the bicentennials, the health and well-being of Indiana's children. So how do we best prepare them? And oftentimes it's from the lessons of history and looking at history from the perspective, as Jim said, of those who necessarily didn't win the war, but were in the war and can tell their particular story. So it's a major emphasis, the bicentennial. And I think this project's really one of the most fascinating things to come out.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's a new multi-part documentary airing on WFYI and other Indiana public broadcasting stations. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Jim, what themes did you want to have emerge from this telling of the state stories?
Well, we tried a little bit for coverage from the Ohio River to Lake Michigan, from prehistoric times to 2016. That's, of course, impossible in 4 hours and even in 400 hours. We tried to select stories that would interest people. We also tried, as Kim said, to select stories that were not well known, that would really be more than just news stories, but that would turn the lens on our view of Indiana history and of Indiana. Stories that, when you incorporate them into the main story, change the main story. And the obvious one there is the story of African-American Hoosiers, but many, many other stories that we hope will do that. So we spent a lot of time selecting stories, trying to find people, the right people to tell those stories, and then traveling around the state to actually do them on the spot.
Which ones, and I'm going to throw this to both Kim and Jim, which parts of the state's history were the hardest to capture or tell? Because some of the state's history, you know, Native Americans and all of that didn't necessarily leave behind written records encapsulating that their experience. And clearly there'd be no video and often no photos or depictions of their life that hadn't been imagined until after the fact. How did you go about trying to communicate that part of the state's history, or those parts, those difficult parts?
Well, the early part is a little more difficult, John, because as you're suggesting, there aren't the kind of visual representations that there are for the 20th century. But we did find people who could tell the stories, as Kim said, of their own families. One of my favorites, and it's in part one, and actually part two, I think, as well, is a woman in Corydon, Indiana, named Maxine Brown, who knows her family history very, very well, has collected documents, and she knows that her ancestors arrived in Corydon, Indiana, in 1814, that is 2 years before Indiana wrote a constitution, and they arrived as slaves, and they made their lives in Corydon, Indiana, and she can talk about those people as though she met them in a way that is very compelling.
Kim, what parts were the most difficult for you?
Well, I think that telling the story of Oliver P. Morton was important and difficult because what he did after the Civil War in terms of financing, telling the story of Lanier, that's not something that people tend to want to hang on to. But we had to put it in because it's really, at first it's compelling once you figure it all out. But, you know, the whole idea that Morton ran the state with a bunch of cash in a safe in his office. So, you know, how did that happen? What were the politics behind it? Telling that story was difficult, and we couldn't ignore it.
Perry, what parts of the documentary have you found the most illuminating, the parts? Because obviously you've immersed yourself in this life and this story. But any time you visit material like this, there are things that have escaped the eye in the past or whatever. You know, what parts of seeing this have taught you something new?
I think any time we talk about early Indiana history, I learned a lot. I'm kind of a lately come historian. And so I didn't know about the Buffalo Trace until 10 years ago, and now I've learned those things. So I think a lot of people have lost touch with that. So I'm waiting to see. I've only seen the first two and haven't seen previews of 3 and 4. But I found the first installment to be so powerful because it's the part of Indiana that we may not know as well as more recent history. So I think the more obscure it is, the better it is for me because it gives me things to talk about.
Jim, what part was the most satisfying to tell?
Well, I can't get over the story of the repatriation. I think about what we're going through in today's headlines, and then you think back at the Depression, where in the steel mills you had both at Inland and U.S. Steel, you had 30% of the workers were Mexican immigrants, 30%. And when the jobs, you know, when the Depression came along, you know, we had the American Legion, we had well-meaning people who put these hardworking Hoosiers on trains and shipped them back. And first it was a volunteer thing, then it was forcible. And I get choked up just telling about it because I can't believe that we did that. You know, it's just, and most people don't know that story, and here we are all over again. And so I think that's in part three. And some people refused to go. Some people went and came back. And I think that story, and you know, these are most of the Mexican Americans lived in East Chicago, still live in East Chicago. Their relatives are there. And I think that's the part that I just saw it replaying itself.
Kim, we're going to head to a break right now, but I'm going to pick up the story again after the break. We're talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana, a documentary series airing here on WFYI. My guests are James Madison, Perry Hammack, and Kim Jacobs. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's WFYI's bicentennial documentary series based on the book of the same name by James Madison, who is also the host of the documentary series. The first two episodes have aired and are available to watch online. The second two episodes are going to air Thursday, August 4th, and they're going to be simulcast on all Indiana public broadcasting stations. My guests are James Madison, who is the author and host, Perry Hammack, who is executive director of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission, and joining us by phone is the documentary's producer, Kim Jacobs. Before we resume that discussion of the state's history, though, I probably should announce some news, and that is that the Indiana Republican Party has chosen Eric Holcomb, the lieutenant governor, to serve as its candidate for governor this fall. He, of course, is replacing current governor Mike Pence, who has become the vice presidential candidate for the National Republican Party. He is, of course, Donald Trump's running mate. And if you would like to find out more information or track this story as it unfolds, you can do so, obviously, at WFYI's website, WFYI.org. So before we went to the break, Jim, and I'd like, actually, both of your thoughts. I asked Kim her thoughts on what was the most satisfying part of this story to tell. Jim, what was yours, or the thing that that illuminated you?
Well, we're obviously celebrating Indiana in 4 hours of television, but it's not only a celebration. It's Perry quoted Indiana Humanities early. I love their motto, read, think, talk. Read, think, talk. And that's my hope for this documentary, that it will cause viewers to read, think, and talk and move beyond celebration, move beyond platitudes, move beyond just happy stories. We all want comfort stories, stories that make us feel good. And many of the stories in these 4 hours will make you feel good. But there are stories, the one Kim just told, of repatriation of Mexican Americans in the 1930s. And there are other stories that will not make you feel so good if you're a Hoosier or an American, that will make you regretful, but make you also think about them in the context not only of our past, but the context of our present. Are we making mistakes in 2016 that we made in 1935? What does the past do to inform us about the choices we're making today?
Before I ask Perry that same question, I got to follow up on that, Jim. I mean, as you're doing this, what mistakes do you see that recur in the state's history that we seem to make over and over again?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. At the center of, I think, Hoosier identity and certainly politics is an affection for small government and low taxes and freedom. And that has many, many positive aspects. But it means, for example, that we've always struggled, and I think we've especially struggled in recent years, to provide adequate education for young Hoosiers, an education that today is going to prepare them for the 21st century. The jobs are not coming back at the General Motors factories in Anderson, Indiana. I hate to be the bearer of bad news. Some Hoosiers, some days, I think, have not quite heard that news, because we're still not investing fully and completely in the kind of education that we need to have for 21st century Hoosiers.
Perry, What parts of this story do you find the most satisfying?
Jim and I were talking at lunch about, I was asked the other day, what's it mean to be a Hoosier? And they didn't want to know from me. They wanted to know from Jim and others of his ilk that know. And I think anything that when we get to that discussion point, especially in small town Indiana and individual stories of people who are famous but didn't become popularly famous, that we scratch off another layer of Indiana and show people how much more there is to the texture of being a Hoosier. And I think these four episodes will all share with us a way of coming up with our definition that we can proudly share, whether we're at the corner store or walking down the Champs-Élysées, of what it means to be a Hoosier.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's a bicentennial documentary series that's airing here on WFYI and other IPBS stations, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. It's based on a book of the same name by James Madison. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Kim, in terms of these more obscure parts of, and I guess I should ask you the same because you've lived this material. Obviously, you had to read Jim's book first, and then think about the ways that you were going to translate that to the screen, to moving images and all of that. What do you see as some of the mistakes that we Hoosiers keep repeating?
Well, Jim would be the better person to answer this, really. I'm going to answer, and then Jim, I would really appreciate your comments about it. I think Hoosiers have traditional values. We want to make good decisions. In fact, if anything at all, sometimes we hold back. We watch. We watch what happens when other people are progressive to see if they fall down or what. But as a consequence, sometimes maybe we're a little slow. Sometimes we, how do I say this? In the name of goodness, sometimes we mess up. Jim, I'm in any time because I'm.
Well, I agree with you, Kim, and that's one of my favorite aspects of history, and that is history does not come in shades of black and white, in binary, off and on. History is always ambiguous. It's only in shades of gray that we can think about our past. And there's lots of good, and sometimes the good and the not so good are mixed up and very confusing, even when we look at them from a perspective of 100 years or more. So today, living today and making wise decisions is a very tough job, which is why, again, I'm all in favor of read, think, and talk as the way to approach where we are and where we want to go.
One of the things that I'd like to see people talk about, one of the hardest things to watch, of course, is a section on the Klan, and Jim's very quick to explain, of course, we've had three different clans, but the clan that we're talking about from the 20s that ended up in the hands of D.C. Stevenson, and the people who joined us, these were like our neighbors, our teachers, our governing officials, and before you we can't really say that they did it because they thought it was the right thing to do. They wanted to have an upstanding society, and it went bad. It just went so very bad. And
is that one of the hardest things about history to get people to see? I mean, there is this, I think, perception out there at times that people who lived in eras before us had simpler lives, or that they were, more virtuous, perhaps a little more naive than we are. I mean, we tend to cast the past in sepia hues and think that the people who lived then weren't every bit as screwed up and confused as we are.
Listen, there is a that Steve Burnett with the Irving. He's never been seen of Matt Overholzer.
Kim, yeah. You're breaking up on us a little bit. Oh. I'm going to throw the question to Jim and see if we can get a little better connection.
Well, I think you put your finger on something that's very important, John. And I faced it every day in the classroom in Bloomington because young college students tend to think, they know it's not true, but they still tend to think as though they're the first generation on Earth. And they believe, for example, I always used to say in class, it stopped them. Do you know that Hoosier pioneers engaged in sexual intercourse? Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, in 1820, we had a fertility rate here in Pioneer, Indiana, that was as high as any place on the face of the earth. So pioneers knew how to grow corn, raise hogs, and make babies. You didn't discover sex when you became 18 years old and came to IU. And that's a way of talking about what you're suggesting, John. The generations before us lived in full technicolor. The sky was blue. Tornadoes came. They were human beings, living human beings, and they had all the shortcomings and all the strengths that we have today. And just because they couldn't use a smartphone doesn't mean they were stupid.
What parts, Perry, of the state's past do you know, because obviously the Bicentennial Commission is all about trying to bring the state's past to life and make people see it as a living presence. Do you find the hardest to get people to see as vivid?
I don't know, John. It really kind of depends on where you are. People tend to relate more to their local history, so it's harder for people from the north, I think, to understand a little bit more of the history of the Ohio River as it is for them to understand some of the Fort Wayne's history. People tend to gravitate towards outstanding characters. We were telling some stories the other day about kind of the backstory of Johnny Appleseed, mm-hmm. and people found it hard to believe that there was another side to Johnny Appleseed that perhaps they didn't know about. So I think the hardest thing is if you learn in history things that discount your accepted knowledge of history, that's the hardest part to get across. It's not a buffalo, it's a bison. No, it's a buffalo. I've had that discussion a million times, not just because of the bicentennial, but it's a buffalo.
Jim, I imagine that task, that challenge of getting people to shed some of their illusions about the past is part of the fun of doing this, though.
Oh, it's a great joy for me, and I've been privileged to be able to do it or try to do it for four decades or more. And it's about sales in some ways, and all good salesmen figure out ways to sell their product, and I've been trying to do a better job of that over the years. I'm blessed, and Perry's blessed too. We chose the right moment to be born because here at this point, we're around and kicking for the bicentennial, and we're both riding those horses as hard as we possibly can. Perry Hammack has probably logged more miles across the state of Indiana from the Ohio River to Lake Michigan than any other Hoosier, and he's mm-hmm. been to these communities. And he sees, as I see, the opportunities that the Bicentennial offers us to sell our product. And our product is history. Our product is the state of Indiana. Our product is a thoughtful engagement with past, present, and future of the state of Indiana. So we sure chose the right moment to be around.
Perry, what has that experience taught you?
Oh, my gosh. I thought I knew Indiana, and I'd traveled Indiana for years and years. But I think the thing that's taught me is that, it's hackneyed, but the more you learn, the more there is to know. And when you break down one more level of granularity, all of a sudden the opportunities expand logarithmically. So as I've read Jim's book, but now I read it again, I read the first book, and now in reading the second one, after having this experience, there's so much more there, and you want to tell about it. You want to tell the story. You want to tell the tale. I'm actually going to be part of a church service on Sunday the whole service is going to be about the bicentennial and how it ties into modern faith journeys. And I think you see connections that you just didn't see before.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's WFYI's Bicentennial Documentary Series. two parts of it have already aired, and you can see online at WFYI.org, and the second two episodes are going to air Thursday, August 4th on WFYI and the other Indiana Public Broadcasting stations. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So, Kim.
John, may I just follow up on something here? And Kim might want to join this, too, on what Perry said about travel. I've traveled the state of Indiana, too. And I want to encourage listeners to do that, to get outside of, if you're in central Indiana, of course, to get outside of central Indiana, to go to the corners of the state, get off the interstate and go to the small towns, get on a canoe and canoe the Wabash or the Blue or the other rivers of Indiana, and walk around the county courthouses. And it really enriches and deepens. And Kim and I have mentioned this numerous times as we've been on the road. You meet Hoosiers and you meet people out there who just are amazingly interesting, who contradict some of the notions of Hoosiers, who often reinforce the best notions of Hoosiers. So my strong advice would be read, think, and talk, but get out there and travel the state.
Kim.
Well, when we started this, the first interview that Jim did was with Judy O'Bannon. And I held her words very dear because she told us in her travels of Indiana that she had come across seven different cultures as well. And she was right. And within those cultures are stories of the Germans, the Irish, and you can't really pick a part of the state that's your favorite. But the one thing I think that they all collectively have in common are this sort of Midwestern values, this Hoosier values. They went to good schools. They went to good jobs. And they've wanted that all through history. It's not like something that we just dreamed up in the last decade or two. They wanted that when they came here. They came for opportunity. And I love Randy Shepard's interview. You know, how they wrote that Constitution and what they had in mind in terms of forging a life out on the new frontier. I don't know, Jim, what your favorite was, but that was one of my favorites.
Jim.
Well, I like Randy Shepard, too. He's one of the few notables. You know, we have some well-known figures who appear on the screen. Former Chief Justice Randy Shepard is one, but most of the people on the screen are just ordinary people. With great stories. Randy Shepard's interview speaks, and I think this is where Kim was going, speaks to the optimism of the generation of 1816. They were living in pretty tough times, and yet they were thinking ahead. They were thinking about the future, and so they promised in 1816 a system of common schools, of grade schools, from a common school, elementary school, to a state university. Even said that tuition would be free at that state university. We're still working on that at IU after 200 years. But their optimism is so impressive and instructive maybe for us.
One of my favorite sound bites came from Ann Emison when we were talking about the first university, Vincennes, and Harrison founded it. And it was, he was also up against all the business with Tecumseh. And so the question logically was like, why a university? And Ann Emison simply said, well, these pioneers, they wanted a life of the mind. And I don't think I'll ever forget that. And here are these people out there trying to find every morsel of food, spending all their time cutting down trees and building cabins, but they wanted to learn. They wanted, what she said, a life of the mind.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's a bicentennial documentary series airing here on WFYI and other Indiana Public Broadcasting stations. My guests are James Madison, who's the author of a book by the same name and the host of the series, Perry Hammack, who's the executive director of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission, and joining us by phone is the documentary's producer, Kim Jacobs. I also should repeat some news, and that is that Lieutenant Governor Eric Holcomb has been selected to be the Republican gubernatorial nominee for the state of Indiana. No word yet on who his running mate will be since he's moving up on the ticket. We hope to have that soon. If you'd like more details on that story, please visit WFYI's website, WFYI.org. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the state's bicentennial, specifically Hoosiers, the story of Indiana, a bicentennial documentary series airing here on WFYI and other Indiana public broadcasting stations that's based on a book of the same name by historian James Madison. My guests are James Madison, who is the host and the author, Perry Hammack, who is executive director of the 2016 Indiana Bicentennial Commission, and joining us by phone is the documentary's producer, Kim Jacobs. Again, if you have not heard the news, the Indiana Republican Party has selected Lieutenant Governor Eric Holcomb to be its gubernatorial candidate this fall. Well, before we went to the break, we were talking really, and I think it was Jim. Well, both Jim and Perry spoke almost poetically about the importance of sort of traveling the state of getting to those places that illuminate the Hoosier experience. I guess, I'll say there are certain places I have been to, not just in Indiana, where you literally can feel the past history as a living presence. Given that all three of you now have had significant experience traveling around the state seeking out those places, can you simplify the process for our listeners by speaking of those places where the past really does come alive, where you feel very connected with those who came before us? I'm going to start with Perry on that one.
Oh, good. I'll beat them because I'd say the same thing they both said. Okay, let's run some down. The Peru Circus Museum in Peru, Indiana. The Clay County Historical Society in Brazil, or Brazil, depending on where you're from. Gene Stratton Porter's home in the Loblolly Swamp are spectacular places. Oak Creek Canyon, Spring Mill State Park, and the whole Richard Lieber story there. Those are places, I think, just off the top of my head that people should make sure that they see. They should go to Angola, and they should go to Amo, and they should go to some of the other towns that Jim will mention. But those are some places where I feel the Levi Coffin House in Fountain City, you cannot miss feeling history as you crawl into one of the spaces where they hid freed and escaped slaves. You can't avoid that history, and then maybe that rises to the top with me.
Jim.
Well, the question is important because we have to have room for emotion, for personal connection, if we're going to really believe there were generations before us. A lot of things are digitized now. You can visit the places Perry talked about online, but it is not the same. Mm-hmm. It is very different to be there and to feel it. And let me just take one of my favorite towns in Indiana. It's Madison on the Ohio River. And even if you've been there three times, you need to go back to Madison and walk those streets and see those pre-Civil War homes and places. But for me, one of the magical places is to stand along a riverbank. Pick just about any river, but let's take the Wabash. Stand along the Wabash and remind yourself that in the 18th century, in the 1700s, there were people paddling canoes up and down the Wabash River who did not speak English. They spoke French, and they spoke Native American languages. And a little bit of imagination, and on a quiet summer day with no traffic or anyone around, you can imagine that happening more than 200 years ago. And that, to me, is the beauty of history and of travel.
Kim, where is the place, or where are the places in the state?
So you saved me for last.
I did.
Okay, three places that I liked. I liked going back to my hometown in Delaware County. Was, you know, when the Hoods moved there in the 1920s, there were 1,000 people, and now it's swallowed up by Muncie. But that was fun. It was fun looking at old film that the Ball State University Digital Archives had of a homecoming parade in Yorktown and seeing my neighbors on their high-wheel bikes. But as far as history, real history goes, New Harmony, loved it, loved it, loved it. and Connie Winesapple talking about how they took those hardwoods down and built those cabins and worked themselves crazy. Love that. And all the way up north, I think, in Lake County, when you think that we were interviewing people and they lived in... within
Kim, I think we've dropped the call.
Let me pick up Lake County, yeah, because there are a lot of favorite places in Lake County that Hoosiers must see. And, you know, Lake County is our most unusual county of the 92. Lake is an outlier, and it's all the more reason why you need to visit Lake County, why you need to see the Indiana Dunes, why you need to go to Gary, why you need to go to East Hammond. One of our interviewers took us, after we did the interview, a man whose family arrived in Lake County from Mexico in the 1920s, took us to a Mexican restaurant in East Chicago. I will never forget that lunch. It was brilliant and magical and historical.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Hoosiers, the story of Indiana. It's a bicentennial documentary series that is airing on WFYI. The first two parts have aired. The next two parts are going to air on Thursday, August 4th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Josh has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, last summer I actually kayaked from Broad Ripple to New Orleans via the White River to the Wabash to the Ohio River and then down the Mississippi.
You're getting
River.
Two thumbs up from James Madison here in the studio. I just want you to know that. Okay.
So I wanted to comment that the I don't know much about the history of Indiana, though I've lived here for the entirety of my life, aside from some outside travel, of course. But the natural beauty that this state has to offer is unparalleled when seen from the river. And I appreciate you guys bringing up the idea of canoeing and kayaking because the White River sometimes gets a pretty bad rap for being dirty or whatever, but so are all rivers, I guess. But I saw in the, you know, the 14 days that I was on the White River, 28 bald eagles from our river.
Wow.
And it was breathtaking. And I think Kim had mentioned New Harmony. Mm-hmm. And what a beautiful town that sits right on the White River. I stopped in for the night and had a couple beers and enjoyed the local, just the local people. And it was beautiful.
So out of curiosity, how long does it take to kayak? from it sounds like Broad Ripple to New Orleans.
Yeah,
in this day and age.
Yeah, last summer I had pulled the trigger on it because, you know, of course the rain was actually absolutely tremendous, so the river levels went up.
Yeah,
across the country, or at least the Midwest. It took me 29 days to complete the whole trek.
Wow. Well, thanks very much for calling and sharing your story, Josh.
That's about the amount of time it took pioneer flatboat men to get down to New Orleans. They made the same trip. Abe Lincoln made that
trip.
He
did.
It's a great trip for young guys, isn't it, Josh?
Well, Josh is off the line now. We've gotten a question from a listener on Facebook. Says, I am African-American and have lived in Indiana for more than 40 years. The State Museum and other locations have invited people to imagine being there during various points in Indiana history. I'm still uneasy to visit some areas of the state, and where I've been, saddened to see the past come to life. Has much been done to recognize the fact that there are still green book sundown towns in our state? Probably ought to explain what a sundown town is.
A sundown town is a place that historically made clear to African Americans that they should be out of town before sundown, before the sun set. Indiana has 200 years of history dealing with issues of race and not dealing with issues of race very well, especially in our first 100 years, 150 years. Indiana has done a little better in the last 50 years since the civil rights movement. I am personally of the conviction and as a historian also of the conclusion that we have not yet created a level playing field. We do not yet have a state and a nation in which justice and equality for all is the reality. In this documentary, in all four parts, we deal with issues of race, we deal with issues of ethnicity, with gender. These are some of the most important stories that we try to tell in each of the four parts of this documentary.
What do you hope people will take away from watching this documentary, Jim?
Well, I hope they'll follow on what we've been talking about this afternoon, John, and that is that this is not only interesting, it's important, and I want to learn more about it. I want to pick a place. I want to learn more about the Wabash River. I want to learn more about sundown towns. I want to learn more about the natural environment. And I want to connect it to the future. We haven't talked yet about part four, but part four
is when we pivot to look at the
is about the future.
Yeah. And that's part of what I was setting up by saying, what do we take away? What lessons do we learn? What are the most important lessons we should learn from the past? Kim, I understand we've got you back now.
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm on the road. And we got cut off.
Not a problem. Are you on your way to Philadelphia for the convention? Or?
Well, right now we're about 30 minutes south of Philadelphia, and tonight we're going to be able to go to the convention and take in some more history.
Okay, well, so I'm going to ask the same question, same question I asked Jim. What do you hope people will take away?
Jim told us early on that one of the goals he had for the program would be that maybe people would gather in their community and watch part one, watch part three, watch part four, and that somehow or another, from what we can best describe as like this is a brush over history, but from watching this, it can generate conversations within their own community about what their stories are. And maybe even inspire some people to say, look, to me, you know, this is a correlation with what we're doing now. We can learn from this. We can change course. We can stay the course. But we can have a discussion about history. Because history is alive. It's not just something that happened. It's something that's happening right now. And I think that was one motivating thing for me, was that, all right, we've got to be able to produce this program. Not everybody's going to be happy because there are going to be towns that say, what about this? You know, you could do a whole hours on towns and their histories. But we just want them to have a conversation.
Perry, what I'm hearing here to some degree is sort of an evocation of the famous quote from William Faulkner that the past isn't dead. In fact, it isn't even the past. it's a living present. It's in our present.
Can I tell you something fun about the production?
Sure.
I mean, you kind of outed me there, telling everybody that I'm in, you know, on the way to Philadelphia.
Sorry.
We did something really fun in the production of this. I'm the widow of Congressman Andy Jacobs, and we're it's pretty well known what our political party is. But we also, a couple of years ago, I had the privilege of working with a young woman who was our intern, and she is Charlotte Pence. She is Mike and Karen's daughter. So we put young Andy and young Charlotte in a car with some of our wonderful photographers, and we sent them around the state together. They never told anybody who they were, but they worked together. And they helped produce this. Their names are in the credits. And I think there was just a little bit of part of Jim and me and Clayton Taylor and all the other folks that kind of said, look, this is what a Hoosier is, and this is what a Hoosier does. And what a privilege. So that's my little behind-the-scenes story.
We are talking about Hoosiers, the Story of Indiana, a new documentary. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hi, all. I apologize if I'm touching on anything you've already been on. I'm from Crawfordsville. And I wanted to see if anybody there wanted to speak to the history of our city. Just to throw in my own part, Crawfordsville is the epicenter of basketball in our state. Protege of Dr. Naismith brought it to the local YMCA, and Crawfordsville High School actually won the first state championship. And obviously, basketball is a huge part of our culture, as well as Lew Wallace having written Ben-Hur while he was a resident of our town. So I just wondered if maybe our little town is a part of your program, or if any of you would have anything to add about us.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Sam. Jim, I'm going to throw that one to
you.
Well,
the answer is yes. We're not stupid. We have a lot of basketball, and I'm standing up on camera in Hinkle Fieldhouse talking about basketball, and Lou Wallace is in there as well. So Crawfordsville is well represented. I wish we could say that about every single town in Indiana, but it wasn't possible. But lots of them are.
What were the hardest parts, Jim, I'm going to stay with you, to leave on the cutting room floor?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think we ended up interviewing so many interesting people. We mentioned some of them, Judy O'Ban and Maxine Brown, former mayor of Gary, Richard Hatcher.
Oh, yeah.
Some of these interviews were 2 hours in length. They end up being 30 seconds or a minute here and a minute there. That's very frustrating.
What stories, though, do you wish you'd been able to include? Because even in a book, I mean, you know, everything is finite. You have to make some process of selection.
Yeah. I wish we could have done even more with the future, with connecting past and future. We didn't want to be too pushy about that, but part four is about the future. And so we have wonderful story from South Bend, a community that is really lifting itself up.
Mm-hmm.
We have wonderful stories from Jasper, Indiana, where they're having a high-speed fiber network being built. We have stories about the new...
I love that story about Dosie Lewis in New Harmony.
Yeah,
she is a relative of Robert Owen. She moved her international business to New Harmony. And it's kind of the tale of what's the future of our small towns, because now she's trying to advocate for faster internet so she can conduct her business there and she can live that small town charmed life.
Right.
I love that story.
And I like the story of the new children's park in Wayne County. We have Mary mm-hmm. McConnell from the Nature Trust walking through that park and talking about it. And it's part of the Indiana Bicentennial Commission and the Bicentennial Nature Trust established by Governor Mitch Daniels. And Perry knows a lot more about that than I do.
Perry, I think that's your cue.
Well, I hope people will take part away to go to our website, Indiana2016.org. If this has inspired you at all to learn more about Indiana, we can help you this year. We endorse legacy projects. We shine lights on wonderful things happening in Indiana, in history, in community, in nature, and also in children. And I hope you'll go there. 1,400 projects. We hope to have 200 2 years ago, and one in every county. And we're seeing this wonderful surge across Indiana of being prouder of where they are, but also thinking about the future. And our tagline is Celebrate History, Ignite the Future.
Well, I think we've established here that an hour is not nearly enough time to talk about Indiana history. I'd like to thank my guest, James Madison, Perry Hammack, and Kim Jacobs for talking about the state's bicentennial. Also, remind everyone that a little bit of history has unfolded this afternoon. The state Republican Party has chosen Lieutenant Governor Eric Holcomb to be the new Republican gubernatorial candidate. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.